You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thank you, everybody. We are here to welcome Pamela Yates, director, and Paco de Onís, producer of The Reckoning, about the International Criminal Court. It is not easy to make a film about any justice issues. As a lawyer, I'm not supposed to say this, but courts are boring on the whole, and it's even more boring if the court really hasn't started yet. So these guys had an enormous challenge, notwithstanding the importance of the issues they were dealing with, but you will see that they've done an extraordinary job, and we'll have a chance to talk with them about the film and the broader campaign that this is a part of.
I just wanted to say, for those of you who aren't familiar with our work, we're Skylight Pictures, and we're a film production company dedicated to making films about human rights and the quest for justice. And we've been making films for 25 plus years. But I have to say, this was definitely our most difficult and complex film. We filmed it over 3 years. It's in 6 languages. And it takes place on 4 continents. The only other thing I wanted to say is that OSI was actually the first money in to make this film. That this organization were the people that first believed that we could actually do this. So that was great. And also the Justice Initiative very early on became one of our outreach partners, because we try to include people who are actively working in the field and have a deep knowledge of the field to assist us while we're making the film, rather than wait till after we make the film to begin a relationship. So that's why it's great for us to be back here and to show it to members of the staff.
Thanks. And I just would add that we're just starting a 3-year initiative, a global initiative to raise awareness about the ICC, and The Reckoning is the flagship or the spearhead of that initiative. Thanks.
I think we have a few minutes. Did you guys want to say anything first before we open it up to questions or comments? Or no?
I'd love to hear what you have to say.
I mean, for myself, I found it, I find the film very, very moving. I think it very successfully attempts to negotiate this the terrain and the differences between the field and inside that remarkably sterile building in The Hague, and to capture so much in 90 or 95 minutes in a way that real people can understand what is happening. I have to say as well, the film itself has been caught up a little bit in, which I think is a reflection that people are seeing it, in the discussion within OSI, the broader OSI, about international justice in Africa. Mm-hmm. And I've heard comments that have been very favorable about the film. I've heard comments around the network, oh yes, yet another piece of propaganda from Reyno Ocampo, so there are all kinds of reactions that one hears here. But I wonder what people here feel.
Speak a little bit to that. You know, the idea behind making The Reckoning was inspired by the fact that so few people knew anything about the International Criminal Court. So The Reckoning is really made for a very general audience, to introduce them to the basic concepts of what the court is. One of the greatest challenges for us was how to tell the story, because we filmed it and told it several different ways before we came to the understanding that the main character in The Reckoning has to be the International Criminal Court, and that the story has to be told from their perspective if the audience is going to understand what this new institution is or the potential of this new institution. And when we came to that realization, we finally got it. We finally got the way that we could tell the story in an engaging enough way. I don't think, though, that it's really a hagiography of the Office of the Prosecutor. You know, we really tried to show the prosecution, or the Office of the Prosecutor in the court, warts and all of the obstacles they faced and how they tried to overcome those obstacles. And we wanted audiences to go away from the film feeling that the court was beleaguered, and that... but that, yes, we should be part of this court, and yes, we have to help the court overcome these obstacles. So that was, you know, the idea for how to tell the story and how to end the story.
Yeah, and it's interesting, what I'm sure as many of you know, that in the last few weeks since the African Union issued a statement saying they would not cooperate with the court, so far over 140 civil society organizations in Africa have signed a statement denouncing the AU statement and saying that they really have no right to do that, especially the member countries of the court, which are 30 African countries. And then, and they're even talking about bringing litigation against the governments in those civil society organizations in South Africa, for example, are thinking of bringing litigation against the South African government for essentially, you know, not honoring treaty obligations. So it's interesting that civil society groups in Africa have reacted very strongly in favor of ending impunity, very much against what the leaders at the AU issued.
I think, actually, I'm sorry, but I think you got to use the mic, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, in the case of Uganda, we certainly heard that all the time, and in that conversation that we show in the film, we tried to address that to some degree. One of the problems of it's that most of the atrocities that were committed by the Ugandan government were before the jurisdiction of the ICC kicked in 2002, and that's one reason that Ugandan civil society have been talking about creating their own court, a national war crimes court. They wouldn't have any temporal jurisdiction limits and would be able to address the whole problem, government and LRA.
But your question is about Sudan, right?
Well, she mentioned Uganda.
Oh,
there.
Okay. Yeah.
The Sudan story we decided to address from the perspective of the Security Council, because it had been a Security Council referral, and then when the case came back with the issuance of a warrant, It really comes back to the Security Council and to the international community to see if anything actually will be done about this. And it really led to the title of the film, The Reckoning.
I had a question, if I might. I realize on second viewing, I heard Luis's statement when he was quite, on July 14th, the day that he presented the warrant against Bashir, when he was very exercised, something like, we have to do this now. Given all the factors, it's not just about the press conference, but many factors require that this happen now. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, because I was in the room when he was screaming at a number of people, because there was I didn't know if you were, I didn't realize you were there at this intense internal discussion an hour before the warrant was issued.
We had a radio mic on Luis. And he just ran out of the room, okay. And then we could hear him yelling and screaming.
Okay.
So I thought, I couldn't quite understand what it was about, to tell you the truth, Jim. But, you know, being a documentary filmmaker, record everything and figure it out later. And so that was really how it came about. But as you can see, it's kind of toned down. It's just meant to really, the stakes were very high. The drama was very high. Were the lawyers going to let him go ahead with announcing the issuance of arrest warrants?
I think you can see how tense he felt on his expression when he gave the press conference.
Yeah.
It was a very tense day.
Yeah. Yeah, because as you can see, so much is at stake, so much weighs on the prosecutor's shoulders when they decide to issue an arrest warrant. I mean, they're really thinking in life and death terms.
And at this stage, he was only requesting the warrant. It actually was issued 8 months later by the judges. Yeah.
Other comments, questions?
Yeah.
Thank you. My name is David Berry. I work for the Open Society Justice Initiative. And maybe I could start by thanking the filmmakers. This is very impressive and moving. And thank you for coming today. I imagine the film might be of some use to allies of the court who find themselves having to explain what the court does and its need to exist. And I wonder if you or perhaps all our panelists might speak a bit, please, about the court's outreach efforts and how those have evolved over time. And I guess perhaps your take on the court's approach to outreach and how or whether the court's outreach efforts have been successful to date.
Well, we feel that the court itself has a kind of weak outreach program. I mean, it's improved in the last few years, but it could do a lot better, especially when you're in the field in the countries where arrests have been made or warrants have been issued. A lot of people just don't know enough about the court. And we set out to make this film 4 years ago because as human rights filmmakers, we were just really intrigued by, fascinated by the idea of this court, this really incredible idealistic goal, and to see, how it would actually play out in the real world, which is what we covered, the first 6 years of the court. And we have an outreach plan ourselves, but it's not meant to replace the courts in any way. It's just that we, as activists, feel it's important that people know what this court is, and starting in the United States, but also globally. And so we make the film available to groups that want to use it, that want to use it to educate. Just last Monday, there was a screening in Nairobi where 250 people showed up, and then they had to open another room for another 100 people. And they were all civil society groups in Nairobi, and it was one of our local partners that organized the screening. And it's interesting because one of the things in the report we got from the screening, one of the things that really impacted there was the Colombia part of the film, because people immediately saw parallels in this complementarity issue, which is going on in Kenya right now. So right away I thought, well, that's good. Once people understand how the court works, it really helps them talk about it and dispel a lot of misinformation about the court. So I think that misinformation about the court is something that the court itself should get better at doing.
Yeah. I think that if you look back when they issued the first arrest warrants in Uganda, the outreach was really bad. And it's come a long way, and it has a long way to go still. And I think that the best partners in outreach have been the civil society partners. I mean, the Coalition for the International Criminal Court's website, all of the people working around the issue of international justice have done, I think, a much better job. And the outreach unit of the court, I think, should really take note of that. And on the other hand, I think, the court is a judicial system. And how much are they going... I think that their outreach should be very specific to what they're doing and why they're doing it. The way that, judicial processes are very specific. And civil society can carry on with the debate and counter-arguments. And the court should really maintain that its own focus.
And I think that now that some trials have begun, like the Lubanga trial and other upcoming trials, they should be, this is my personal feeling, that they should have screens, big screens in big halls in places like Bunia, in places, in different places in the eastern Congo, let's say, that are fed in by satellite and they're live and people can go in and actually see the trial happening. Nobody's going to go every day. It's like, well, most trials are boring, so they'll step in and they'll know but to know that it's there, that it's public, that you can go in and see this happening, at least, brings it a little closer to home. Others have spoken about setting up a trial right in there, taking it to Bunia, but we were there and the security concerns would be so enormous, I can't imagine what it would cost to actually move the trial to the site. That would be a whole other level of outreach.
Well, yeah, just on that latter point, there have repeatedly been suggestions of in situ trials or in situ proceedings in the trials. And I recall discussions inside the OTP which were trying to reconcile everybody's aspiration to bring the court to the communities that it was concerned with most directly, and at the same time dealing with the reality that as a security matter, none of the parties to the case, none of the judges wanted to incur risks of a kind that one would have to in order to actually make that happen. And the discussions were all framed by the public perception is we need to bring the court to the ground, but the reality is we simply can't do that given the security problems that we face. And I don't think they've ever fully adjusted the public lens and the reality inside of what would have to be done in order to make that happen or the significant constraints on that.
Don't you think that if it was coming in through video,
absolutely.
So the witnesses weren't actually there, they're in a different location.
Or even radio.
Video
is very challenging to bring into places like Bunia. Satellite video, and it's very expensive too.
Mm.
So even radio, just something that was a constant reminder that this is happening, and that world has a relationship to this world.
Right. Or at least the court can also do better than it's done in terms of the opening statements in which it, I gather, it made available the statement of the prosecutor and of the victim, but not of the defense, so that in the public fora in the DRC, the defense opening was left out. That was seen as some pretty big gap, and certainly it can correct those kinds of mishaps, I guess, going forward. But no, I didn't mean to suggest that outreach is good enough, and they I agree they ought to be doing more. But there really is an enormous gap between what people want and I think an appreciation of the security risks of doing live proceedings there.
Right.
Other questions, comments?
I'm Lee Hollingview from the OSI Library. I just wanted to ask you what your plans are for screening the film and having it shown in the U.S. and around the world. I mean, can you get it into theaters at all, or do you have to depend on film festivals and special events? I know it was screened in New York at the
Human Rights Watch.
Philanthropy New York. I'm thinking of Philanthropy New York, which used to be New York Regional Association of Grantmakers. I know they screened it, but I just wondered how widely you feel you can have it viewed.
Sure. We as Paco mentioned in the beginning, really The Reckoning is just the flagship for a three-year audience engagement campaign in the United States and around the world, because we're going to make multiple language versions, and we're going to work with our line producers in the situation countries who now have become our outreach partners. But in the United States, we actually had a national broadcast on PBS, and you can now stream The Reckoning for free online. So we wanted to make it available as widely as possible. It's really interesting in the world we live in that actually the more that you give away, the more you get back. And so we found that by making the film available free, streamed, schools, law schools, colleges, high schools are buying DVDs of the film, and individuals too. They actually want to own the DVD. But we're also developing shorter educational modules taken from the film and material that we didn't use in the film for high school curriculum. And we've developed a 40-page discussion guide to help teachers at the college and high school level use the film. So we're going to work this film for quite a few years. And we developed a global social network site, too, called ijcentral.org, International Justice Central. There's postcards up here if anyone wants to take them. Paco can tell you a little bit more about that.
Yeah, ijcentral.org is, we thought that after the film, after seeing the film, people might want to get more involved in the subject of international justice. They might want to get active around it. So ijcentral.org is set up as a resource. We, over the last few months, has developed a Twitter feed which is all about international justice. And if it picks up tweets that have International Criminal Court in them or Moreno Campo or anything, that would pick it up. And so through that, it's been expanding to where there are now 800 people involved in this. And it's become a really great information sharing resource. We get news about events all over the world with links that take us to stories by local newspapers and things that are happening. So that's developing well. It aggregates international justice news. We put all videos of that are issued by the court, like the Lubanga trial, which you're also doing on the Justice Initiative site. And OSJI, we consider one of our partners. We're working with a whole bunch of NGO partners. And this network of partners, which includes the usual suspects, Human Rights Watch and OSJI and Amnesty International, CJA, there are many screenings being organized around the country through POV, the series that we broadcast on PBS. A lot of these things are already available. The modules that Pam was mentioning, two of them are up there. One is a short one about the history of the court. Another one is about the Sudanese case. The next one coming up is about the peace and justice debate. The entire film can be screened for free, streamed for free. You can get a screening kit sent to you. You just have to apply if you want to organize a screening in your community. POV will send you a screening kit with a DVD and a discussion study guide that goes with it, and also tips on how to organize a screening. So all of these materials are available. Getting back to the idea of theatrical release, we don't do that. We used to do that. We don't do that because theatrical releases involve signing a contract with a theatrical distributor, and it's based on a Hollywood model that, you know, depends on having a good box office weekend. And for us as activist filmmakers, that's is basically absurd. So we feel that by doing a long-term, three-year, you know, rollout, we have festivals, we have the national broadcast, but then the real work is with screenings and working with things like the Human Rights Watch Traveling Film Festival, which goes to 40 cities. And that way, and through law schools, over 120 law schools in the U.S. have already have the reckoning. They're already using it. And so in this way, it's a slow build, but it will have a long, long, and much deeper impact.
You know, basically, the idea is that film is an emotional medium. We try to get the story across through the situations themselves. And if you're successful at doing that, then at the end of the film, people want to go the next step, or they want to stay in the moment a little bit longer. So by having several, many outreach partners, we want to bring new constituents who know nothing about international justice, who are just hearing about it for the first time, to those organizations that are already doing the work. Because it's not really about us as filmmakers or even about us as the film. But how are we going to get a general audience interested and energized to know more about the subject? And that was how we really conceived of the film's relationship to the outreach campaign.
It's a brilliant insight. I remember when I saw Sophie's Choice, and I was so deeply moved by it, I had to go find the pink house in Flatbush, Brooklyn, where she lived. I wanted to engage in some way, and there was no Sophie's Central. So this is brilliant.
Did you find it?
I did find what I think was the pink house, yeah, although it may be just my image of it. I don't know. Amanda, other colleagues?
I thought that my name is Amanda Wetzel, and I'm an associate with the Justice Initiative. And I thought that the film dealt well with, or at least began to explore, the issue of amnesties and the way they're discussed at the higher levels of the International Criminal Court, and then also how they're discussed at a local level in Uganda and maybe beginning to be discussed in Colombia. And I was wondering if you could tell us how you chose to frame the issue of amnesties, because I felt that it, at least in the Ugandan example, it was definitely framed on a local level with folks talking about it, and less on a procedural level at the ICC in terms of how they view their responsibility of engaging in the peace process and at what level amnesties will be respected and not, even if they're given. So I thought if you could tell us how you decided to focus on that issue in the film, that would be interesting.
We weren't privy to a lot of information at the International Criminal Court, to tell you the truth. It does seem like we got really inside and we got a lot of access, but there was a lot that we weren't privy to. And I think what we've tried to convey is what it's like to be sort of part of the team as they investigate. We were a lot more privy to that conversation that was happening on the ground in the situation countries. And I'm always looking for ways to have the actual participants in an idea voice the idea rather than kind of the people overseeing it on the procedural level. So that was really why the choice was made, to highlight that conversation. And it's interesting because that scene in the film has been the subject of a lot of people have commented on that scene a lot across the United States, especially African Americans, because they're so they so little see any kind of sophisticated conversation coming from people on the ground about, and so cognizant of their own situation and brainstorming of ideas for how to better that situation. And so
how to self-empower themselves.
And how to empower themselves. So I thought that scene was so powerful, it would definitely override any scene I could, or any interview I would do at the court itself. Would you have liked to have seen more of that thinking from that perspective?
No, but it's one of the fundamental changes of, you know, having the Rome Statute and having countries sign on to the Rome Statute. That when you sign on, you're basically saying amnesty is no longer an option for these kind of crimes, at least for the top leaders. In Uganda, they do have amnesty for everybody except the top five leaders that were indicted by the ICC. The government has had an amnesty option up for a long time, and many child soldiers have managed to escape, have taken that amnesty. But, you know, the mandate that was given to the prosecutor, essentially, he can't give amnesty. He doesn't have that power. You know, it's not part of his job description. So, you know. I don't know. What do you say about that, Jim? I don't think they can.
I mean, in terms of discussions inside in The Hague, amnesty really is not an option. We operate on the premise that these crimes, for those most responsible, we're dealing in a legal environment in which amnesty has been taken off the table. I think in every situation in which I was concerned, that was the operating premise.
We went to a conference in Nuremberg a couple of years ago. Were you there, Jim?
No, I was not.
And it was interesting because there was a panel with some of the top conflict negotiators in the world were there, and they were really complaining loudly that, you know, the ICC has taken one of our main tools off the table. You know, how can we resolve these conflicts without offering amnesty to the perpetrators? And so that's just this kind of reckoning once again. It's just, you know, the decision made by 120 countries that drafted the statute that amnesty should be taken off the table.
To what extent is the film primarily for an American audience, a North American audience? And, I mean, in your mind and in point of fact, and to what extent have the audience reactions around the world differed depending on where they are?
Well, we're American filmmakers. So, of course, we want to energize and activate an American audience. And we want Americans to question or to learn about the American role in the International Criminal Court. And this section we have in this film is, like, really small. It's like a fingernail compared to what, you know, has happened since that moment. But so that's first and foremost. We really wanted the film to be an international film, though. We really wanted it to be used in the situation countries. And we've made a couple of different versions. We're going to make multiple language versions so that it can be. Probably we've shown it most in the United States because it premiered at Sundance and then it was shown on PBS, and now we're really launching the international campaign. But people's reaction here has been that they really want to talk about this idea of no one being above the law. And what are we going to do in the United States? If laws were broken, should evidence be followed? Should people be convicted? And can people in the United States, can the leaders during the Bush administration be brought before the International Criminal Court? There is not one public screening that goes by that someone doesn't ask that question.
Or in the comments that have been coming into the POV site, that where people can write comments, there's a lot of that too. And you know, we always tell people, really, it should be the U.S. prosecuting. If there's gonna, you know, we shouldn't need an International Criminal Court with the justice system that we have. And you know, personally, I hope there will be some accountability, but the Obama administration has been kind of slow on that. But another question we get asked after every screening is, what's Obama's position vis-a-vis the ICC? Everybody wants to know that.
And there's one other thing, which is that very few people and even civil society organizations in Latin America know what's happening in Africa and vice versa. And one of the things that I found that the film has done is has begun to cross-fertilize the discussion. Just a little bit, though. I mean, it's the tip of the iceberg. But if we hadn't included the Colombia section in that, I don't think that ever would have happened, and it would have been a really different animal, this film.
And I thought the section on Colombia was great, in part because it's really the less told story of the court.
I mean,
people just know very, very little about it, and they know very, very little about the role of the court in catalyzing political processes at the domestic level and having domestic impact even without the initiation of a formal investigation. And I think that is a story that has to be told because, of course, Moreno Ocampo started when he came into office saying we'll succeed if we have no trials because others are deterred from action. That was a little bit tough to achieve without some work, some trials by the court itself. But I think it's in that spirit that what is told about Colombia is so important.
Yeah. Well, when we started the film, we thought the film was going to be about arrests and trials, and you know, we were going to, and this was going to be like a whodunit, and we were going to follow
law and
the
order
trial.
On the international
yeah,
stage.
Law and order on the international. But the first trial didn't start till 2 weeks after we finished the film, and so very quickly we realized that actually the film was going to be about the effects of the International Criminal Court, and that was a much more subtle story to tell.
And as filmmakers, it was fascinating to learn that ourselves. That's part of the satisfaction of documentary filmmaking. Sometimes is when you do have that personal journey too, learning about a subject that you've dived into, and then you realize it's not as it seemed. And when we started to see the effects that the court was having, I'm still very encouraged by that. When we heard, when we were fortunate enough to be in Uganda when Patrick Mukasey came out of the bush, the LRA commander that defected, and it took us about 3 weeks to get an interview with him. They weren't letting him have interviews with anyone. And he was in custody of the Ugandan government. And so when we finally did get the interview, and he said, Kony and the other guys, they talk about the ICC every day, five times a day. And I thought, oh my God, they're out there in the bush, in the Congo, and they're talking about the ICC every day. So that's another effect. They all talk about Charles Taylor. So they're very well aware of when punitive measures have taken place, and they do not want to go down that road. So, and this causes, of course, the big problem there in Uganda. But I don't know. That's somewhere you have to draw the line, I think. So, yeah.
Okay. One more comment? Okay.
I was curious about whether you had seen the question of Western developed world bias, and I didn't really see it as much in the film, and I was wondering if that was a choice and so forth.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean the idea that this is a Western-dominated court?
Well, that some of the actions of the court in terms of choosing cases to pursue, it was nice to see the Columbia piece in there as well, have been... So for instance, the United States hasn't had the same sort of conclusion to the situation as the Sudan did, even though both of them presumably were in similar situations. Neither of them had signed the treaty.
Yeah.
And of course, there are a lot of differences in what happened following that, but it wasn't really brought out. And a question that I had in my mind after that was, well, why was that so different? And I think if you read some of the literature out there, people do often accuse the court of
Well, in the case of Sudan, like, as you say, it's not a signatory of the court, and neither is the United States. And, there you come right up against the problem of the permanent five on the UN Security Council and who makes those decisions. By the same token, at one of the Security Council meetings that we filmed, the representative of Costa Rica got up and said, we joined the court because we don't have an army, and we thought that the rule of law is what's going to protect us, and so we can't, we don't have a rule of force in our case. So, to protect us against aggression, we thought the court was essential. And actually, the court was formed, two of the big driving forces at the Rome Conference were the Latin Americans and Africa. Africa is the continent with the most members. And so it's a kind of dichotomy there about the court, because when the cases are self-referred, which most of them have been, that's one thing, or if the prosecutor himself opened the case, which he hasn't yet. But then you have the Security Council, which raises all these questions, and also, about Israel and the Middle East. And, to the countries of the Middle East, I would say the best thing you can do is join the court. If Lebanon had been a member of the court when it was attacked, then, Hezbollah and Israel would be investigated. It would just automatically trigger an investigation. But since they're not members, it can't happen.
Okay. Well, thank you to Paco and Pamela for this wonderful film and for taking the time to be here and share with us your experiences. And we look forward to IJ Central and other ways that we can engage with you in the future.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming. Thank you.